Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. This episode is an audio version of a virtual panel held at the Linguistics Career Launch in the summer of 2024. The video of this presentation is available at the Linguistics Career Launch YouTube channel. Links to the presentation materials and to other resources mentioned are in the show notes. This episode of Linguistics Career Cast is generously sponsored by Amazon Science. This episode is titled, The New Role of Faculty, Advising Linguistics Students. Did you know that a draft-eligible baseball player has better odds of playing Major League Baseball than a new linguistics PhD has of getting a tenure line job? It's true. In this session, panelists Alex Johnston and Sue Steele review the real data on academic employment outcomes and the other opportunities beyond academia that are available to linguistics graduates. This presentation is aimed at linguistics faculty, but will be relevant to students and advisors too. Topics discussed include job market, academia, tenure track positions, PhD outcomes, faculty advising, career outcomes, alumni community, and career resources.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Linguistics Career Launch 2024. This is billed as a presentation to faculty, and I do see some faculty here. Maybe you could put a reaction in your Zoom box and show us who's faculty here, but this will also appeal to everyone who is here. If you're a student, you'll learn ways to talk to your faculty members and your department about things you may need to support your career. And if you're faculty, I hope you'll find a lot of useful advice here. I'd like to have my colleague Sue Steele say hello to all of you, and then I will start our slides.
So it's good to see you all. And let me echo Alex's expectation that this isn't it, while it's aimed at faculty, there is important information I think that students will find valuable and can use to frame how they go forward. So let's start.
Great. And you should all have links to our slide deck so that you can follow along with us, skip ahead. And we look forward to having some engagement in the chat as we go through, but we'll save the direct question and answers until the end of our session. And I hope we have a lively discussion, but please do use the chat if you have comments and questions. So just quickly, our title, New Role of Faculty in Advising Linguistics Students, Data on the Employment Landscape for Linguistics Graduates. I'm Alex Johnston. I'm the Director of Master's Programs and Career Management in the Department of Linguistics at Georgetown University, where I direct 5 master's programs. I manage career advice for about 100 linguistics majors and over 100 graduate students at the master's and doctoral level. And I'm also an associate professor of the practice. Sue, would you like to briefly introduce your history?
Hi, I'm Susan Steele. I am retired. I was a long-term academic, mostly at the University of Arizona, but at other places as well. And then I became an academic administrator, went on the dark side, and I did that for sort of the second half of my academic career. When I moved away from that, I became interested in nonprofits and was the president of a nonprofit organization. I'm still actively writing and researching, and I care deeply about this topic. I was the graduate advisor, the director of the graduate program at Arizona for almost 10 years, and it was something that, while that was a while ago and things have changed a bit, that was something that really concerned me and took my attention during that time. So this is a faculty member sitting in their office, you know, working as usual. one of your advisees, could be an undergraduate, could be a grad, well, this is mostly for a graduate student, they say, well, I know I'm supposed to be a professor because I'm here in graduate school, but if I don't do that, and you answer, well, this is after a person has also been trying to get a job and it hasn't looked good. You say, well, you know, why don't you just try again next year? Because it rolls around and you're really good. So just keep doing it. That's one possibility. That's one answer you might give. Or you might say, well, why don't you try for a postdoc? Or you might say, well, there are other possibilities besides higher education. You could teach besides universities and colleges. You could teach at a K-12 or community college. That's always an option. Or you could say, well, why don't you go into industry? And you make a lot more money than I do. Isn't that right? Why don't you do that? And what else might you say? You could say, oh, why don't you learn to code? These are all answers that, you know, that you might come up with. But what we want to talk about is, what other answers could you give? And here's the list of the things that are topics for today. One of them is, what are the realities for linguistics PhDs and master's students and undergraduates for who are looking for academic jobs? What is the reality here? What do linguists in business and government and technology and nonprofits actually do? That's the second topic. And the third topic is, what you and your department can do to make your students successful in their career search and their career journey. And the final thing, this is for all students, right? And the final thing is to talk about what resources are available to you and your students, free resources about for all degree levels. Okay, so that's what we're going to talk about. Now, so you're a faculty member, and at your first orientation meeting with your incoming graduate students, you're looking at all these shiny faces and, you know, and you're introducing them. What do? These is a pop quiz. So one possibility is you explain the program. You know, you talk about what you do in the first year, when you're going to take the various exams along the way. All these things that make up the graduate program. That's one thing. Second thing you can do is tell them where to find the first party of the semester. I was, as I said, the graduate advisor. I did the first two always. The third thing you might do is discuss the realities of the academic job market and explain how your program addresses these realities. That's the third thing you might do. Or you can do none of the above or all of the above. So let's see your answers.
Okay, so A answers. A answers mostly. A and C. So
some people got C.
Yeah.
A and C. Well, that's of course Brendan. We knew that you would do that, Brendan, but I never did the third thing. I didn't know what to say about that. So I hope that at the end of this discussion, you will be better equipped to do C than I ever was. Wait, one says, Crystal Chen says, I honestly don't remember.
Was there an orientation?
Yeah, maybe we didn't have one.
Maybe there wasn't something comprehensive. There's all different experiences here.
Okay, so next, this is another pop quiz. So remember, now we're talking about academic, you know, what is the employment landscape? So true or false, in 2022, less than 15% of social science PhD holders got jobs in academia.
What do you think? So
you can answer it in the chat, whether you think that's true or false. True, somebody says true, true, uh-huh. False.
Okay, getting a mixture, and by true, less than 10%, maybe, possibly, Brendan. Okay, so yeah.
It's true. It's true. Okay, next pop quiz. True or false? A draft-eligible baseball player has better odds of playing Major League Baseball than a new linguistics PhD has of getting a tenure line job. True or false? True and go Phillies. Yeah.
This is where you jump in with your own baseball.
I put this question in because my nephew is the manager of the Baltimore Orioles, and they this year are they're at the top of their league, and I'm the O's. Yeah, the O's. That's them.
The Orioles.
So it's true. So they have a draft eligible player has a 9% chance of being drafted according to the NCAA. So now let's look at linguistics PhDs. Remember, we were talking about social science PhDs before, and that was 15%. So what is the likelihood of a new linguistics PhD getting a tenure line job in linguistics? And Alex has done a lot of research around this question, so I'm going to turn it over to her.
Right. So we're going to drill down to our topic of interest. What do linguistics PhDs do with their degrees? And what's the likelihood of a new linguistics graduate getting that tenure line job in linguistics, which has long been considered the end all be all and highest and best use of a linguistics PhD? But a lot of us deal with anecdotes in departments. And this is what I hear in all the departments that I interface with in my own departments I've been a part of. Oh, well, you know, some of our graduates get tenure line jobs. My own students, for example, every faculty member knows what their own students have done, or maybe some stand out in memory more than others, but they don't have a comprehensive view of their own department or of the academic employment landscape. So this was my research question, like, what really is the likelihood? I wanted to figure this out so we can deal with real data. We should be dealing with real data. We are linguistic researchers. So first, to answer this question, I wanted to find out how many linguistics PhDs graduate every year. And I think this is something we should all know. How many PhDs are being produced? So I sourced the number of linguistics PhD graduates for the 3-year period of 2020 to 2023. And the source of all this information is the NSF Survey of Earned Doctorates, which I have linked to here, so you can check my stats. And this is the best source of data on PhDs in the US. And it is highly comprehensive. You can search it for the employment outcomes of doctoral degree holders in every field. You can look at those doctoral degree holders by demographic information, by citizenship. It is a very excellent source of data about PhDs. So for our purposes, I added the number of linguistics PhDs and the number of applied linguistics PhDs that were produced in each year of that cycle. And I did that. Those of you who are on F1s will know what a SIP code is already. But the SIP code is what is the number that is assigned to every academic program in the country. And it's a standardized way of referring to academic programs. And this is how the data is collected and compared. So because every academic program is assigned a separate SIP code, I've excluded neurolinguistics, psycholinguistics, and all language graduates. So people who got doctorates in Spanish or Japanese or other languages. We've excluded them, not because these aren't our colleagues or that we appreciate these fields, but simply because they are assigned different SIP codes. And it's, I want to compare apples to apples with the number of jobs and the number of graduates. So this will become more clear later on when I tell you how I coded the types of job ads. So, but for interest's sake, we did keep numbers of graduates from these different programs. Now, I want you to guess how many linguistics PhDs graduated in 2022. And these are the linguistics PhDs plus applied linguistics PhDs. Was it 44, 70, or 263? What do you think? going to see in the chat if you are up there.
See.
All right.
Oh.
Yeah, you were on it. 263 in 2022. Okay, so keep that number in mind and we'll come back to it in just a bit. Now, returning to the research question, now we have to figure out how many tenure line jobs are advertised every year. So to do that, I and my research assistants collected all of the US-based tenure line job ads for these 3 years. We excluded all contingent and term limited jobs. So no postdocs. We didn't count non-tenure lines like me. We didn't count visiting assistant professorships. Anything that was term limited and didn't have the possibility of tenure was excluded from this. Again, because the focus on tenure line jobs is so high in many departments and programs. And that's also the model that we see in the people who are teaching and training us in linguistics departments and programs. They are tenure line and non-tenure line faculty members. So I looked at three job cycles, started collecting in May, ended in December for each of these cycles. And the sources were the typical ones. The Linguist List, which is the clearinghouse for jobs, not only in the US, but around the world, but I was focusing on domestic US institutions. So I excluded positions available overseas. We also picked up jobs through social media, Twitter X, department announcements on websites and other publications. And then my assistants and I coded them based on the discipline within linguistics. Is it formal linguistics, applied sociolinguistics, computational, or general? So just a quick kind of clarification about some of these sub-disciplines. The general category included some smaller subfields like historical linguistics or typology, language documentation. Maybe there would be one of these open per year, if any. So we collected all of those into one general category. Formal linguistics means what's often called theoretical linguistics in our departments and programs, phonetics and phonology, syntax, semantics and pragmatics. And then we also had to exclude some types of jobs. We excluded Lang plus Ling, which means you have a linguistics PhD, but you also have a specialization in a language. So maybe you received your linguistics degree from a department of a world language, so a department of Spanish and Portuguese, and you went on the linguistics track within that department. So you graduated with a degree in Spanish and Portuguese, but you had linguistics training. We excluded these because it's very difficult to tease apart these jobs, job ads that ask for a language specialization in addition to linguistics. That requires additional expertise and training in how to teach those languages typically. So that's why we excluded them. Again, because of the different SIP codes assigned to all of the different languages, we couldn't track all of those, but we did include the numbers just for interest's sake. So those of you who are the Lang Ling specialists will find some of your open positions listed in a graph. We excluded neurolinguistics, psycholinguistics, and cognitive linguistics because, again, these linguistics degrees are assigned different SIP codes. They come from many different departments and programs. All right. And if you did anthropology and linguistics, we collected job ads for linguistics anthropology and anthropological linguistics. So we collected those. Sometimes those, typically, if you are in an anthropology department and you do linguistics, then you'll be coded for anthropology and your degree will be in anthropology. So that degree would not be counted in our study. So the only PhDs that we counted were those that were specifically coded for linguistics and applied linguistics. Thanks for these questions. So based on all our collection of these open job positions from May to December in these cycles, let's focus on 2022, how many domestic US tenure line jobs were advertised in 2022? What do you think? Are we going to be even with the number of grads? Nobody thinks so. Indeed, you're right. There were 44. Let's break that down. So this shows us the 3 years of the cycles that we looked at. So the dark green is 2021, 2022, and you'll find the most recent data for 2023, 2024 in this light yellow. The jobs that we added up were in these five subfields: applied, computational, theoretical, general, and socio. But just for interest's sake, I show those of you who study linguistics within a world language department the jobs available, and we see this nice uptick in this three-year trend. That's great, but there were still only 27 in the most recent cycle that we found, and far fewer jobs for neurolinguistics and psycholinguistics. So in 2022, if you add up 5, 12, 17, 2, and 8, you'll get 44 open positions for those 263 grads. So 263 grads and 44 jobs. What do you think, Sue?
Well, that's, you know, that's not bad. You have a one, look, if you divide it out, you get a 1 in 6 chance of getting a tenure line job. That doesn't sound too bad, right? Problem is, it isn't a 1 year thing, because if you don't get a job 1 year, as we saw in the first, your advisor might say, well, why don't you try again next year? Because you're really good and you'll have another chance. So you have the people from last year who are competing for those jobs. And it turns out that people are waiting longer and longer, applying more and more years, so that you have a backlog of people applying for those jobs. So when you really compute it, it's not 16%. You have the 263 joining the other three preceding years, and you have over 1,000 PhDs competing for these 44 jobs. So what's the chance now? 4%. That sort of should hit you in the gut, right? 4% of eligible PhDs might fill those 44 jobs. I know somebody who, this was a while ago, but he spent 7 years, 7 years in 1 year positions. He was in China, he was in the Netherlands, he was in upstate New York, he was in Oregon, he was in Arizona. He did get a PhD, he did get a tenure line position finally, but 7 years. And you think about what that means in your late 20s, early 30s, 7 years of wandering and not having any, you know, not having any security or knowing where you're going to be next year. That's the reality.
Right. And I do want to mention that when I was counting up these jobs with my research assistants, we erred on the side of generosity in counting these open positions, because we know from ourselves as faculty members sitting on hiring committees that not all of these positions actually get filled. There are a lot of failed searches. And within the pool of jobs that I looked at, I knew for certain that there were several failed searches. And we had ways of checking up on that. And, you know, we were contacting departments. So a lot of those searches failed and were not reopened. And sometimes, you know, the budget is pulled and they don't continue forward. Sometimes they don't find the candidate. They don't find that elusive fit. So.
And somebody notes in the chat and that we didn't count in those, in the number of people that were searching, people who aren't new grads also applying. Right. I mean, people who want to change jobs or things like that. So it's true. I mean, that's the data though. So the question is, seeing how 96% at least of PhD people, in linguistics PhDs aren't going to work in academia, what do they do?
Right. So I want to show you some publicly available employment data on linguistics PhD placement from one anonymous linguistics department. We won't try to guess which one, but this is a model for you, I feel, of the type of data your department or program should collect and should be really stringent about collecting, because it's, I believe it's for everybody's benefit. So in one department, checking the past 5 years of PhD employment outcomes, I found that about a quarter of the PhD graduates went into tenure line academia. That's sounding pretty good so far compared to what the four, compared to that 4% statistic we just saw, but we're going to break that down a little further and complexify the situation. We also see that about a fifth go into contingent jobs in academia, and just loosely using that term contingent to mean contract positions, 1 to 3 year positions that are not tenure line. 40% or so went into private industry. We're going to break that down a little further. About 7% into government. 3% did not have a job 6 months past graduation. And this smaller percentage is for the students, about 2% or so, who went into nonprofit organizations. But let's really break down this statistic a bit. By citizenship. And I feel that this is very significant. So if we break it down by citizenship, only about 12% of the PhDs produced in this one department in the past 5 years went on to tenure line academia. And this is because often international students who come to departments to get training may have jobs waiting for them in their home country, or maybe they are seeking jobs in a third country. But it is a very different employment outcome for domestic people seeking jobs in the US. And I'd like to show that just in the past 2 years of those PhD graduates, 28% went on to tenure line academic positions in departments and programs across the US, but 100% of them were international students. So we're seeing that domestic US students are not getting tenure line jobs 2 years after graduation. And that the number of years post-grad before landing a tenure line position is rising. And we know that from the work of Ricker Dockham, who presented at LSA this past January, and the work of his team in tracking the growing number of years between graduation and finding a permanent academic job. And again, what is permanency these days? We have departments being eliminated. We have programs being shut down. So, and in addition, we have state legislatures that are legislating tenure out. So tenure is under threat. Read Project 2025, or, you know, you'll find out that tenure is not what it used to be. So moving on, as Sue was saying, given that the vast supermajority of linguistics PhDs will do something other than tenure line academia, in addition to nearly all of your master's and undergraduate majors, this means that the tenure line jobs are the most alternative career choice of all, if it is a choice. So what are the jobs that our graduates actually do get? And so here's where we really focus on graduates from all degree levels. I could give you statistics from the Survey of Earned Doctorates, which breaks it down very nicely for graduate employment outcomes for PhDs, but I know that we're dealing with students from all degree levels. So I'm going to refer us back to a study that the Linguistics Beyond Academia SIG performed in 2019, and we're due for a redo of this survey, which we will do. So back in 2019, we wanted to survey career linguists, like those who are coming to the LCL and giving presentations, workshops, and appearing on panels. So based on our own networks, we sent out a survey, received 139 responses from linguists at all degree levels working beyond the academy. And you can see that degree breakdown here. And we wanted to see their career trajectory. So we surveyed them for both the first position title post-graduation, the subsequent position titles and their current position titles. So we could see that entire cadence and track it. And these were the titles.
Yeah.
Not an exhaustive list, but I'd love to see what you notice.
I can't make sense of this list.
You can't, Sue? Why is that? What do you notice?
I don't recognize any of those labels.
Right.
I mean, I was looking for something that would say linguist, well, there's some there with linguist in it, but most of them don't have that. So
you're right. There are so few linguists in the titles that linguists actually get. And I want to point out that as we've been talking about throughout this entire conference, we can't glean a lot from position titles. We really have to look at job position advertisements. So a linguist, I'm kind of heartened to see that some people got jobs titled linguist, but this means something very different in every sector. So a linguist who works in the US government, in the military, is going to be somebody who speaks English plus another world language. And they are going to be doing primarily translation and interpretation work. And they will have been trained to do that work and to analyze language data from that additional language. However, if you're a linguist like Chris Stewart working at Google, that means something very different. You're doing something like programming, you're writing code, you're doing things I have no idea how to do, but you are working as a linguist with language data and coding and working with databases and using SQL and Python. It could mean something very different in the nonprofit sector as well. So linguist means different things in different sectors, and we don't see it a lot. We also don't see communication a lot. Instead, we see job titles like this that show a cadence of responsibility and don't tell us a whole lot about what those projects are that people are working on. So you have to read about those projects. Is this a project based on some kind of language data or working with different populations of language users, working with different language varieties? What could it be? And analyst. There are a lot of analyst positions. Does that have anything to do with working with language data? So again, we can see this broad spectrum of titles, and we don't know for sure if people are actually working with language or doing the kind of work that they did as homework for linguistics classes, if you know what I mean. But we want to put some faces to these jobs and introduce you to people at those different degree levels who are working across all of these sectors and give you examples of people working in a variety of positions.
So here's somebody who has a bachelor's degree from the University of Colorado, sorry. And she is now head of product at Walmart Global Technologies. And so she does product design with conversational application, voice user interface. This is a person, she's pretty amazing, what she's been able to do. You know her, right, Alex?
Oh, yes. She's been a long time contact. I've known her for the past 5 years or so and tracked her from her first position postgraduate from University of Colorado Boulder until this acquisition of one of her startups and one of the startups where she worked and where she co-founded the startup, and just seen an amazing career trajectory for somebody with a bachelor's in linguistics. So there's no barrier to entry in industry or government or tech with respect to degree level. The degree level that you've achieved may give you a leg up in your position in that organization, but it doesn't mean that you can't enter into all of these sectors with a bachelor's degree. And I really hope that we can eliminate from our vocabulary just a bachelor's or just a master's, because really for most jobs, that is your qualification. A bachelor's, sometimes a master's, very rarely a doctoral degree.
So this is another person whose name might be familiar to you, who has an MA, and she says, proud proud ABD holder from the University of California, Berkeley, who has made a name for herself in a naming company that she founded. So she, I don't know if you've done it, if any of you have ever done anything having to do with creating names for new products. That's what she does. It's really interesting work. So I was thinking about somebody who, and linguistics has interesting implications for that. I was thinking, this wasn't a story about Laurel, but another friend of mine who also worked in naming, and he was supposed to be finding a name for a new cereal or something. And the name that he came up with was something, I can't think what it was, but it was something that had a lot of cuz in it, like crackle or something like that. And the people that were using him said, well, why do you like that name? And he said, well, cause it sounds crunchy. and he was explaining that you've got these velar stops that, and the people that were the company said, he said that the owner of the company or the director or something said, somebody write that down. like this was big news, but it was something that, linguists just know. So the things that you can bring to bear that you know that lots of people don't know. Most people don't know.
That's true. Things that we take for granted in our linguistic knowledge, things we consider very basic, are just like mind-blowing moments for people in other sectors in a really wonderful way, because they start to realize that linguistics is a science. and hearing some technical jargon kind of convinces them of that. But naming as a process and as a profession is not only about the sounds and about searching for creative names. It also involves a lot of technical work in vetting those names and making sure that they are allowable under law, doing the background research. For example, pharmaceutical names can't promise cure, for example. So you have to do a lot of vetting and making sure that they're unique names and that they follow certain guidelines. It also is a profession, as Laurel says, where you are working constantly on different projects at the same time. So you can move from project to project at different stages, and it can be very, exciting if you are a person who loves variety in your work. So please try to talk to Laurel in our mixers and office hours. We've also heard from Mackenzie Price. Dr. Price graduated from Georgetown with a linguistics degree and shows us how we can use linguistics in anti-bias research and in making sure that companies have inclusive language in their content. So Mackenzie is able to analyze content for a very large publishing organization. Meredith is one of our big publishers in the US, and she sets guidelines for inclusive language and makes sure that language is accessible. And she provides a lot of guidance to their clients. Another linguistics doctoral degree holder from Georgetown, Aishner Sadich, was trained in multiple research methods, both quantitative and qualitative, and is doing applied research in industry. And as part of first the Minerva Project, and now as director of market research at Amplify, she is able to set strategy for the organization's internal and external research agendas. So doing what she loves, research in an industry setting, and she's able to use her quantitative methods and her skill with Qualtrics and with analysis to show program evaluation and to use that to continually improve programs and products. Another person who is part of our career launch is Alexandra Boti, who has a master's from Georgetown in sociolinguistics and who works as a radio podcast news program producer. And a lot of people might think, Wow, you can't get into journalism without a journalism degree. But Alex Boti is very outspoken and a wonderful advocate for linguists to go into journalism and go into story finding. Because with our focus on audience design and with our skills in pattern analysis, we can trend spot. We can find out what's in the news, what's coming up, and make pitches to producers in order to get stories that need to be heard on the air, whether it's in broadcasting or podcasting. So talk to Alex about how you can use your linguistic skill set if you're interested in media, mass media and journalism or broadcasting.
The last one, he's one of my favorites. I think he was at the LCL 2021, I think. I can't remember for sure, but this is a guy who got his MA in sociolinguistics from Cal State Long Beach. He grew up in Long Beach or in the area, got a degree there, and was very committed to making government accessible to the people in the community, people who maybe didn't speak English. And he did the hiring and training of the first in-house translation and interpretation team for the city of Long Beach. He was just a real powerhouse. And he now has been moved on to being senior health equity educator in Minnesota. I don't know how he's making the transition from Long Beach to Minnesota, but that's so, I mean, it's not, it's also, you know, he's just built this career out of a commitment to language access and based on what he knows about linguistics.
I'll just briefly mention Reva Schwartz, who is one of my heroes because she has a master's in phonetics and she now works at the National Institute of Standards and Technology here in the DC area, this government agency, where she engages in AI risk assessment and works in the area of AI ethics and citizen advocacy. So on her team, she is working constantly with computer scientists and with engineers and people who develop AI systems. She is the voice of social science in the room. She is the voice of someone who has studied how people use language, how populations use language, and how they can be affected by AI tools. So, as she says, when there are socio-technical systems, which is how people use technology, that's a socio-technical system, we need the socio-experts in the room to talk about the effects of these tools on different populations and, you know, in our world. So she was instrumental in developing the first AI risk assessment framework that was published by NIST and is a foundational framework for risk assessment that is now being used by many organizations. And she continues to make great strides in continually assessing risk. So if you're interested in AI ethics and bias and risk, this is something that a linguist can do. Now, we want to throw this out to the faculty in the room and kind of get a sense of where are you in your journey of supporting students' career exploration?
I think this is a range of things that, why don't you put them all up? It's a scale, and want to know where you fall on this scale. So from I'm opposed to industry career preparation as part of a linguistics program, and isn't understanding the current theoretical landscape enough? I've spent my whole life in academia. I'd like to help, but I'm at a loss. I enthusiastically encourage my students to explore all career possibilities. I invite alumni back. I help my students build networks. My syllabi include readings and projects that pertain to industry. Where do you fall on this scale?
The first one, I don't think we'll find a lot of people raising their hands, but I still encounter colleagues who have this idea. And I really hope that we can reach those colleagues with your help, by spreading these resources, by spreading the ideas of the Linguistics Career Launch, and by reassuring your colleagues that not a lot of work is required of them to support students in these diverse career pathways. We have one final kind of, you know, stage of the journey here, and that's I've created a project in collaboration with departments like computer science or our School of Business so that interdisciplinary teams of students can develop products and services for academic credit and industry preparation. We could go all the way there. We could be very interdisciplinary and help students gain get credit for interdisciplinary products, interdisciplinary projects that they work on with students from across schools or across departments. So let's see if we can move toward this stage in service of all of our students.
I'm seeing in the chat that a number of people are at three, or think they're at three, but they're moving towards four and five. And I'd say that when I was in academia, that's where I would have been too. It's a process. It's a process. And this last thing would really, I mean, it would involve a lot if you know about how universities and colleges work to get, you know, departments working together in some kind of course that students can take, all of the things that have to be done to do that. But it could be really powerful if has anyone in the audience done anything like that?
Well, if there isn't, then I can give you some ideas, and especially when it comes to how syllabi can be created to support this. And we're here to help. We're not here to call anybody out about what stage you're in or to pass judgment on any stage, because this is truly a journey and everybody is in different contexts. But if you do have that urge to help your students and you feel like you're at a loss, just remember, you're already teaching these highly valuable transferable skills in your courses now. So what you can do is to name and emphasize those skills and talk about how transferable they are. So what are those skills, you may ask? We know all these things. We know how to develop a good research question. This can be applied across industry. This is no small thing. Just being able to develop a question and develop appropriate research methods and methods of analyses, that is a sought after skill for applied research positions. We know how to design and execute end-to-end research projects. So we can do that process from start to finish at different degree levels. We can do that as part of a team and as an individual. We're really comfortable with managing large quantities of unstructured data, whether it's a small problem set, whether it's a corpus or comparing corpora. We are trained to seek patterns and to measure and manage and taxonomize patterns. We can apply different tools of analysis, qualitative, quantitative, or computational methods. We know discourse analysis, we know ethnography, survey instruments. Some of us are learning R and Python, and we can do things like playback analysis with our research partners to gather more and more meaningful insights. And this is part of user experience research. But Sue, wait, there's more.
Oh. Yay. Even more skills, right?
Yes, we can recruit and train participants for interviews, focus groups, and research projects. And this is very transferable, especially in user experience research. We know how to develop rapport, and we know how to train people to develop rapport. We can perform semi-structured or cognitive interviews, which is also sought after in business, government, and nonprofit work. We can act as participant observers and use ethnographic methods. And these playback analyses we can do if we're in discourse analysis or interactional sociolinguistics or these think aloud protocols from applied linguistics. This is also user research. So there's a very short leap from the methods of sociolinguistics and applied linguistics to user research, although there might be a bit more of a leap in actually finding those positions and finding a good fit. Yeah, we know how to get research projects approved through different compliance processes. We know how to deliver results in very tight turnaround times, which are tighter in industry, but less exhaustive in some contexts. And we can deliver these analyses, results, and recommendations, or as we might call them in industry, insights, in different formats. We can write executive summaries, although that can be hard for academics when we're used to writing long things. We have to write abstracts, so that's an executive summary. We can write things like white papers. We can make multimedia presentations at the drop of the hat. We have to do that for every class we teach. And we can adapt these presentations to general audiences. Consider intro linguistics and how we have to reach a general audience and gradually train them to become more specialized. So we can also, we can create these audience designed presentations.
So yeah, this is the thing to remember, is that you're not alone in making this transition from, on the scale that we had, from a 3 to a 7 or an 8. So here, there are a number of resources that you can take advantage of. I wanted to notice also something in the chat that somebody said about what they did in terms of their undergraduate students. This person says that she adds links to industry resources related to topics and links to internships and stuff in, if she can find out about them. So that's on the list down towards the top of the transition. So, but there are free resources that you can take advantage of. Campus Career Centers, sometimes yours, they vary, but if you have a good one, take advantage of it. What others? Give students the names of alumni who've made the transition, and use LinkedIn as a, how many, most of you are probably on LinkedIn, but you can use it as a research database.
Right. Not only to learn about careers and the language and keywords you need to be able to speak to different audiences in different sectors, speak to potential employers, but also, you know, I have been very surprised when I've been part of faculty meetings and we do kind of rundowns of our doctoral students, and we kind of in these private faculty meetings, see where these students are, how they're doing, and kind of, you know, there are always students who have perhaps dropped off the radar a bit. That shouldn't happen, but it does. And I have been shocked when my colleagues say, well, they haven't answered my emails. I don't know what's happening with them. I don't know where they are. And I just take the opportunity during those meetings to look them up on LinkedIn, and I find that they have jobs. I find that they are, you know, still in the program, but they are working and they're getting experience and they have their, you know, non-university emails listed there. Like, there are ways to find people. But you know, my colleagues in different departments don't tend to think of going to LinkedIn to see what's up or doing a Google search. So remember that those people who are in degree programs might be thriving as their, you know, their advisors may think that they should be working on their dissertations, but they may be thriving in a job that is not their assistantship. So try to track down not only current students who may have, you know, set aside their degree program for a while, but also those alumni. So easy to find them. So you, as a faculty member and advisor, can understand just a bit about that employment landscape with some of the data that I gave at the top of this presentation. Just know for real how difficult it can be these days to land a tenure line position in linguistics, and how uncontrollable that process is. Even when you have good people, it is a lottery at that level to a certain extent, and the combination of luck and circumstance and connections, and as well as the ranking of your doctoral program. You want to emphasize the transferability of the linguistics training you offer at all degree levels to all of these sectors of employment. You want to know how to direct your students to career management resources. We still have a ton that we link to in this presentation. And this doesn't take a lot of cognitive energy because it's all right here for you. I'm not saying you have to learn everything about every job ever, but just know how to direct your students to these resources like a traffic cop. And, you know, when you have time, reconnect with your graduates who work outside of academia and see what they're doing. It's probably something really interesting that you have no idea about. I'm always learning. This is part of what I love about connecting with alumni is I learn about all of these jobs that didn't exist when I was in training, that didn't exist two or three years ago. And it's a constant source of continual learning, which I thrive on. And I just think it's so fascinating. And then I can direct those connections to my current students. And then there are ways to incorporate team-based learning to your syllabi. This is highly sought after by employers who get things done via teams. We're not working individually when we're a member of an organization. We're usually teamed up with people of complementary skill sets. So the learn how to code thing is not that great of a piece of advice, because if you are in a development and design team, it's likely that the linguist there is not there to code. You will have somebody to code and to develop, but you as the linguist are the social scientist in the room. You are the one who is going to think about the users or the people or the communities who are affected by what you're designing or what you're researching. That's your specialization and how you complement the team. And then what your department can do, gather those stats. And come to this consensus that you need to encourage diverse career pathways, just given how programs are under threat and how we possibly want our departments to survive. If we want them to survive, I think we have to show a solid career outcome to deans and to people handling budgets. Collect that comprehensive employment outcome data and discuss it in a faculty meeting. Make it available to all faculty, not just administrative staff or not just one person. This is something that every faculty member should know about the outcomes of their own training. And then present that outcome data to your students, current students and prospective students. This is great for transparency because you show what your program results in. And that can be great for recruitment. If you're proud of your results, that you send students into a diversity of career outcomes, that can be very attractive to students. That's why a lot of students choose Georgetown, because we can show that we place students in a healthy variety of career pathways of interest. And then try to connect your learning goals of your courses with potential employment paths. We can talk more about that in the Q&A section. And what your department can do, other free things, leverage your alumni community, track all of them, including ones who leave. I don't like this metaphor, but you want to track people who do not finish their master's, do not finish their doctoral program. They are doing interesting things. They are thriving. Track all those employment outcomes. Invite those alumni back to give talks. Host a career mixer with those alumni. Alumni love to come back. They love to give back to students. They love to show that what they do with the training they got. And for those who haven't continued on to a doctoral program or those who haven't gotten tenure line positions, it's a way to be really inclusive. When I went off after my doctoral degree into the wilds of Iowa, into a not tenure line position, trying to make my own business happen, trying to work with nonprofits, trying to consult. It was like I dropped off the face of the earth. I mean, my beloved department had nothing to do with me. It was like I was invisible. For a long time, I was invisible. And I know a lot of alumni who have felt the same way when they haven't gone to fulfill the goals of some of their faculty members by following in their footsteps and getting that tenure line job. But when you include those alumni and you see the amazing things you do, I think you will be really proud of your training. I think you'll be proud of how they have used your training in a variety of careers. And I think you'll be inspired by that, I hope. And just encourage these alumni relationships, really leverage the community as much as you can. We have all these resources for you. The only podcast devoted to linguists discussing their career journeys, Linguistics Career Cast, hosted by proud ABD Laurel Sutton. Linguistics Career Launch YouTube channel, into which we're funneling all of these recordings. So it's 75 videos and growing, because all of these recordings from LCL24 are going to be edited, hand captioned, and put into the Linguistics Career Launch YouTube channel. These are all for your students. We have a full-on resource guide developed by Emily Pace, one of the LCL organizers, which is like a syllabus in terms of how to advise your students, how to direct them to all these resources we've made for you. And if you're a member of the Linguistics Society of America, join the LBA SIG. It's very easy now to just click on LBA SIG membership if you're a member and you log into the LSA website. So join us. And we present at every LSA meeting, panels like this, presentations like this, as well as career mixers. If you can only watch two webinars from the LCL YouTube channel, watch these two. This is a further explanation of free and easy steps your department can take to open up to non-academic careers. It also answers questions about, should I tell my advisor that I am seeking careers beyond academia? And says, maybe not. You'll have to find safe people to talk to who you know will support that. And watch the human language technology jobs introduction, which kind of shows a continuum of how much coding do I have to know for jobs in technology, from a no coding to a lot of coding. Books about careers for linguists. Anna Marie Trester, the original, who wrote the best books on using linguistics in different sectors. I use Bringing Linguistics to Work in my career management class. I think this is an excellent read for anybody who wants to be inspired by what linguists can do using their training. We have a couple of books forthcoming, we hope. So keep after us to get these published. Finished.
Alex has a deadline coming up, so you encourage her to finish it because we all want to read it, right?
Do we? We'll see. I don't know. Remember, you got this. We are here for you. Connect with us. Let's talk. What questions do you have? And what questions have been in the chat that we haven't attended to?
There's been a lot of discussion of the coursework and how to build in things into. So who has other people? Do people want to comment on some of that?
I have my own way of incorporating into a syllabus. If I could kick that off, it might be of use to faculty in the room or for students who may want to talk to their faculty about it. So I teach intercultural communication, and I love it. And that's what I do for consulting. So I bring a lot of my consulting insights into the academic study and academic discipline of intercultural communication. But for the class deliverables, I offer different pathways. So for the doctoral students who are going through degree milestones, they can write a research paper, a data analysis paper, and that can serve as a qualifying paper for one of their degree milestones. Awesome. But for students who are interested in getting, like putting a, dipping their toes in the water of consulting, I offer them to imagine themselves as a consultant trying to take the academic research on intercultural communication and turn it into actionable insights, turn it into a training module for a specific audience. I say, you've been hired by an organization of your choice to speak to an audience of your choice. What can you tell them about intercultural communication that will help them in their daily lives at work, that will address problems they have, communication problems at work? What activities can you use? What kind of structure? And that is their practitioner's project. So there are ways to develop practitioner's projects for a lot of different classes, and to give students the chance to, you know, learn how to train others. through taking research and turning it into recommendations for others. And that is the leap that a lot of academics have to learn how to make when they go into industry, because it's no longer finding out what's interesting about data or what's an interesting thing that you noticed. It's about how do we use what we've learned? How should we use what we've learned? How do we turn these insights into actions and recommendations? So for students, that's a really big leap after being trained to just, excuse me, after being trained to in academic genres of writing, where you present your conclusions, you have a discussion, but you don't focus on the potential policy applications necessarily, or you don't focus on how companies can use these insights to have their employees communicate better. This is a way to jumpstart them into that.
One of the things, are there other comments? When I moved from academic teaching and research to university administration, one of the things I found as a linguist that I was able to do that other people from other disciplines weren't, I was able to, so you're dealing with lots of, big, messy, messy data sets of people. I was trying to deal, there was a huge problem with course availability and trying to figure out how to solve that problem. And I could do that. It didn't seem like it was a difficult thing, whereas it had been a problem. I mean, and it was really my linguistic training, I think, that allowed me to make sense of that, to look at the data, sort of trying to just make sense of it. And the other thing is that I found, and this is when you're not an academic, is that there's an immediacy about the work that you do. And I'm sure this is true in industry too. I know it's true in nonprofits, that there isn't in academia. The work that you do there is, I mean, with your students, it can be immediate, but most of the stuff is, you don't see the impact, or you don't see the impact for years. But when you're in other kinds of positions, industry positions or administrative positions, the impact, you see it and you feel it, and it's really powerful. So it's not, so you, I think about that as it's not, there's a real benefit to these jobs that you just don't have in academia. I mean, there are things that they bring that you just don't get in academia, which, right, I think is important to keep in mind.
Right. More immediacy of application and result, and potentially far wider reach.
Right.
Because very few people read our peer-reviewed journal articles, sad to say, but there are going to be hundreds and thousands of people who are reading, yeah, Reva Schwartz's AI risk assessment framework and using that as guidance, policy guidance in their companies. I want to point out something really great in the chat. Crystal and Brendan are having a great discussion. Crystal is saying that I'm seeing it's really important for faculty to frame coursework in terms of transferable skills, maybe not all the time, but often enough, for students to recognize how what they do in the course can be pitched to potential employers. And I want to say, plus one, yes, yay. But also, when I have talked about this to some of my colleagues, not naming names, I've faced resistance. Colleagues have said, it seems so transactional to say that we're learning skills. Can't we just enjoy linguistics and nerd out for the fun of it and enjoy in the, amassing of knowledge and creating of knowledge and just revel in that? And I'm like, yes. And I think it's highly positive to encourage your students with, look what you can do. Look at all of these amazing things you can do. Look at these skills we're learning. Because students forget, we all forget that we have an incredible array of skills to deploy, to answer questions and attack problems. And I think it is just additive to be able to say, remember, it is a really great thing to do pattern analysis. It's, you have developed systems thinking. These are not skills everybody has. I mean, we're in privileged positions to be able to be trained in these types of skills in our degree programs. But it's something that when you talk about it, you realize that it's special to have this skill set. It's applicable to the world, and it's ways that, you know, it gives us ways to solve problems. So I hope that you can continue, you know, as Crystal was saying, like, it's not like every day you're constantly pointing out, here are the skills, but as Brendan said, you can include them on your syllabus as learning outcomes, as you had a great way of phrasing that in the chat, Brendan, and I know you're going to be talking about this more. So a list of acquired skills and knowledge for each course can be part of your learning objectives, please.
So first and foremost, this is an awesome presentation. Thank you all very much. It's for any other faculty or those who, right, just instructors, right? All of us are teaching at different, right, whether you're at the MA level or the PhD level. I think there's a lot. I mean, y'all just gave excellent ideas. There's so many really easy ways to do this. And I think a lot of times, right, there was none of these discussions happening when I was in grad school. And I think a lot of us can relate to this, which is really exciting. It's happening now. And so, I remember grad school, when you talked about industry, it was like, oh, you must not be serious, so you don't talk about it, right? And you keep going on. And so I think for anyone who is here, I guess, advising students, I think it's really important to be very vocal about it, which is interesting, right? You'll get different responses from different colleagues, and that is what it is. But I think overall, right, to be vocal about, like, hey, like this, like, and right, something that I mentioned with Laura last week, when we were talking of, like, it's really interesting how our field of linguistics has become very quantified, very statistically oriented, but there's this wild cognitive dissonance with number, percentage of jobs available, right? That, like, it's like, well, if we know those numbers and we're good with numbers, why aren't we talking about this more often? And so I think, and I said in the chat there, right, there's a conversation I had many years ago with Cindy Blanco. We overlapped at UT Austin for a while. Super good folk, wildly impressive. And this kind of like light bulb moment in 2020 for me of like, okay, we're so obsessed with knowledge in academia, which is cool, but like we actually have skills. We don't talk about those, and let's separate those and talk about them and incorporate them into our classes. We already probably have a lot of those workshops, right? Maybe it's a discourse analysis workshop that I do in my language ideologies class. Maybe it's a statistics workshop I do in my quantitative sociolinguistics class. Those are all skills that are then used throughout the semester. And what's awesome with the LCL videos, you can say like, hey, look, they're using these exact skills in this position in industry. And I think those are kind of ways to kind of normalize of like, yeah, what you're doing here can be applied there. And Alex, I think to your point, it really is interesting. And there's a lot of conversations happening right now of like, well, why do I need to like sell like my classes or this? And it's like, well, we're at a really interesting time in history of just how much things cost. So yeah, if I was an undergrad or an MA, I'd be like, yeah, what can I do with that? And how can I survive? Right. And so like, yeah, they want to know, like, and you should explain to them, you should know those things. And I think there's a lot of resources. Yeah, exactly. Return on investment, and their parents too. And rightfully so. And I think as faculty, we can do a lot of those things. So anyway, I see we're at time. I will stop talking. Sorry. I did say I have a big mouth on that. I would just say to any other professors out there, I would love to be in conversation. If you want to reach out to me, I've done a lot of things, but there's still so many more things I think I can learn from others and want to continue to make graduate education and undergrad better for like industry focusing. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Brendan. I so appreciate your allyship and support. And, you know, I do want to reiterate for faculty here, do, as Brendan said, be explicit that you support all career pathways, that you will be the type of advisor who is safe for people to talk about careers, to talk about post-grad employment placement, to talk about money with. Because when we don't talk about money, we are just reinforcing that linguistics is for the privileged and for the generationally wealthy. We are excluding so many people who need to, we all need to make a living, but some of us need to pay those bills immediately for ourselves, for our families, and we have to support people. It is not shameful to talk about money. It is necessary. And if we withhold that information from students, we are just replicating the inequities in the profession of linguistics that have always been there, that have kept it relatively white, and pretty privileged. Not many people can go into a degree program and go into debt for it without knowing about outcomes. And I want all of my students to get a return on investment. You know, we can't just sell these programs and not have a return for students and say, here is the real data on where your colleagues are going to have gone. So please, you know, remember that this is a way to support diversity within the field and to make linguistics the place that is inclusive of everyone by talking about money, talking about career outcomes, and supporting all of those outcomes, and thinking realistically about how students will support themselves with the training we provide.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.